Coming up today, running shoes, baby news, penis bones, and Yahoo woes. You're listening to episode 298 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hey.
Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
And Liat Clark.
Hello.
New issue of Wired, out now, double issue. That means that there's not one for another month after this one comes out, but it also means that it's extra thick, lots of festive reading. This issue, we go behind the scenes with some of the world's most important tastemakers, as we call them, including Lucasfilm's Kathleen Kennedy and Drake. We also go inside Sellafield to see how it's cleaning up UK's nuclear waste and find out the amazing story of the UK's £500 million cocaine bust haul thing that happened on a tugboat a couple of years ago. It's an amazing story, lots to read. Go and buy it or subscribe. Let's start with a thing you learned this week. Who wants to go first? Don't all rush at once.
I will.
Go on, Liat.
James, if you go on The Guardian this week, there's a fun quiz that will challenge what you think you know about your own country. They've basically created this quiz from an Ipsos Mori survey across 40 countries, and it's looking at all kinds of things like country population, attitudes towards homosexuality, the number of Muslims in a country, all kinds of things. So I'm going to test you guys on two questions to see if your expectations meet with reality. Okay. How many people do you think are resident in the UK? What's the population in the UK?
Well, I know, so I'll shut up.
I did this and I got it really wrong. Is it like 63 million?
Well, I must say that Amelia was looking over my shoulder at my notes earlier and she said she wasn't, but
no,
I think she was.
I actually did this yesterday.
It is 63 million.
Can I guess 63 million?
You may. So one of the things that they found was that in China, their average answer was like incredibly off. It was something like, what was it, 71 million short of the real total. But in the US, they underestimated the population by 21 million. Now, anyway, on to the next question. What percentage of the UK population do you think is Muslim?
I know this.
I actually knew this, yeah.
I'm going to say 12, and I don't know. I genuinely don't know if that is miles off.
Amelia, did you also look at this over my shoulder?
No, I did it yesterday, but okay. So I think
so. You know,
I'm going to guess about 11.
So you
11.
Can't guess. Okay, well, you're both wrong. It's 4.8. In France, they overestimated by 24 points, and I think that the worst lot after that was South Africa, the Philippines, Italy, Germany, Belgium, and the US.
And in the UK, it was by about 15 points. So most people guessed it was about 20%,
yeah,
which is way off.
That's just silly, isn't it?
Was there one more?
No, that's it, guys. To find out more,
yeah, head
we'll
to the
send
Guardian.
Our readers,
it's a really good
readers
quiz.
Away from us to The Guardian.
Very, very interesting. You can see how incorrect people are around the world and lots of different preconceptions. Amelia, what did you learn this week?
Speaking of people that don't know things, this week we had a look at the highest trending Google searches for 2016. And I'm sure you'll all be really happy to know that the most common question across London, Birmingham, Leeds, Glasgow, Edinburgh, Liverpool and Bradford was, what is Pokemon Go?
Well, what is Pokemon Go?
A fun augmented reality game where you get to run around and chase Pokemon.
And as we know here, Pokemon Go drove a crazy amount of readers to the website when it first came out. It was phenomenally popular. So yeah. It kind of makes sense that it would be. Although in a year where you've had a major presidential election and a major referendum on membership of the European Union, well, you know, you thought that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There we go. But Pokemon.
But Pokemon was really big, and also the World Cup. And then one of the other questions, which was that was one of the most searched, was what is the mountain of butterflies? And this is where millions of monarch butterflies in Mexico attach themselves to a special tree, which I don't think I can pronounce properly, in the Sierra Madre Mountains. And nobody knew where these butterflies went before 1975, and that's a really big deal. And it looks really beautiful.
And I presume the reason it was popular, maybe Google did a doodle about it, something
like
that.
Yeah, I think it was a Google doodle to mark like 41 years earlier in January. So in January of 2017, you will know the answer to what is the mountain of butterflies if Google puts it on their doodle again.
It's a mountain of butterflies. Matt Burgess.
So the dating app Tinder, which we all probably know, you get a picture of somebody, you swipe left to say, no, I don't like that person. You swipe right to say, hey, they look okay. Maybe I can make myself have a socially awkward conversation with them. So Tinder has released...
Dating sounds fun in your world.
Tinder's released the names that people most likely swipe right on.
So the most popular names on Tinder.
Yes. And for males, it's Harry, Jay and Thomas. And for females, it's Amelia, Holly and Grace.
Congratulations,
well
Amelia.
Well done, Amelia.
I know. I'm winning the Tinder game without even trying.
I learned this week a fact that I want you to guess. It's not quite as deep and meaningful as Leah's. How much does the average mute swan weigh?
I don't know. Mute swan?
You can guess in kilograms.
5.
Matt Burgess?
I'm going to go for 12.
Strong.
That was in my head too, but I think that's just... I'm going to go 8.
Matt Burgess is 1. It is 11 to 12 kilograms. There you go.
I know swans.
You know swans.
Oh, God.
Okay, and later on we'll find out that you know penis bones, which has been probably
not
the
related.
Funnest story in the Wired office this week. But we'll start off with something a little bit more serious. 3.2 billion people are connected to the internet on this planet, and Yahoo just confirmed that 1 billion of its user accounts have been hacked. So that's not particularly great. And we've been here before. Earlier this year, Yahoo announced a separate breach containing 500 million user accounts. There's likely some duplication, but these are two separate attacks.
Also from years ago, so whatever damage has been done has been done.
Yes.
They're just informing us.
So this latest breach started in 2013, but Yahoo only just noticed, and it noticed while investigating the breach that saw 500 million user accounts leaked. The old breach of 500 million users was allegedly state-sponsored, Yahoo said, but it hasn't said who it thinks is responsible for this attack.
How can there be a huge hack of 1 billion customers and you not realise until 3 years later?
Yes.
That raises some serious questions about Google security. Yahoo security.
Yes.
That's really disconcerting.
It's fairly bad. And the kind of information that they've taken is also fairly bad. So it doesn't include any payment or credit card details. It's basically a similar breach to what happened with the 500 million users, but times it by two. So no payment card details or anything like that. But you have, if you're a Yahoo user, and that also means if you're on Flickr or things like that, your name, email address, telephone numbers, date of birth, hash passwords, and in some cases, unencrypted or encrypted security questions and answers have been stolen by someone and could at any minute be posted on the internet for anyone to feast upon.
I mean, they would have done it ages ago, though, wouldn't they?
What, posted it?
Yeah.
No, someone would have noticed.
No, but as in, like, it's not like they're going to do it now. That it's been discovered. This has happened.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, it's such a huge, huge trove of data.
It makes you think there's someone very smart, there's something, you know, it's not like they've just gone after credit card information and they think the first hack was government sponsored. So it's kind of...
Yes, and this one started before the other one, they noticed that the breach occurred before, the initial breach occurred a year before the 500 million breach. So, I mean, they might be connected. We know very, very little. But what we do know is that Yahoo security is looking fairly poor right now.
And what should people do?
You might say that they should stop using Yahoo, but that would be something for an expert to say. Yahoo says affected customers should change their passwords, review accounts, and consider using Yahoo's authentication tool to remove the need for passwords. So two-factor authentication, which is kind of what they're saying, is a good idea. If you've got things like an Apple ID or a Google account or a Facebook account, you can set up these two-factor authentication systems that mean that you have to use your phone or a text message or a phone call. Microsoft has a really good app that you can use for these things. It's a great way of adding extra security. And please, please, please use a password manager. If your password is the same thing on lots of different sites, particularly if you're a Yahoo user and you've got the email from Yahoo saying you've been included in this breach, go and change all your passwords. Do some spring cleaning just in time for Christmas.
I did get that email, but I don't remember having a Yahoo account.
Yeah. So you probably had a Yahoo account or a Flickr account or something. And this is the problem, actually.
I think it was probably something for Flickr years ago.
Yeah, years
and
years. I mean,
it.
Yahoo is kind of retro. And it's also a bit of an issue of writing about technology. You tend to sign up for lots of accounts for things that you never intend to use. And then they get hacked.
Such is life.
Such is life.
I hope it's a teenager somewhere who's just like...
Well, as we saw this week, the person that carried out the attack on TalkTalk was how old? 16?
Well, he's 16 at the time. Yeah. He's just been sentenced and now he's 17.
Yeah, so he's been given a rehabilitation order for an attack that caused tens of millions of pounds of damage to TalkTalk, which is an internet provider and phone operator here in the UK. For Yahoo, this is going to cost an awful lot more and be very, very bad for business, especially when you're trying to finalise a $4.8 billion acquisition deal with Verizon.
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because I think the story we wrote about this said that Verizon has asked for a discount, as you would, but the damage was done years ago and no one even knows what the damage actually is.
So yes.
It's such a bizarre set of circumstances.
Yeah, and there's a genuine risk.
Maybe
here.
Verizon.
Yeah, maybe Verizon did it to get a bit of money off. They probably didn't. There's a genuine risk here that the people or whoever that carried out this attack is still in the system. If you've been in it that long, you've probably gotten very, and you've been able to stay hidden for that long, you're probably very, very good at hiding yourself. We don't know a lot about it yet. Some of the very good security researchers that normally look into these things will be taking a hell of a long time with it, and the data hasn't surfaced anywhere. So normally these things, well, not normally, but often these things will come to light because someone will go, there's all of your accounts on the dark web. But this time it's Yahoo coming out and saying, yeah. Other large data breaches revealed this year include 117 million LinkedIn users. That didn't stop Microsoft from buying it. 85 million Dailymotion accounts and 339 million adult Friend Finder accounts. It's not going to go away anytime soon. Your best defense is a good password. So go and set it up. Our second story this week, Amelia and Matt, but we'll start with Amelia. Nike wants to break through the 2-hour marathon barrier. That's shaving off an awful lot of time.
Yeah, it's in order to break. So the current record for the marathon is 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds. So if they want to get it down to less than 2 hours, the athletes need to shave 7 seconds off each mile in the 26.2 needed to complete a marathon.
So depending on how you say it, Nike, but they've assembled a crack team to try and solve this problem.
Yeah, pretty much. It's called Breaking Two, and it consists of three elite athletes. Disisa, who won the Boston Marathon in 2013-2015. Kipchoge, who set the London Marathon 2016 record of 2 hours, 3 minutes, 5 seconds. And Tedesi, who is the men's half marathon record holder at 58.23 seconds.
If he can double his half marathon, then he's nailed it.
Well,
just keep going.
There is that.
The pace that they have to go on is absolutely crazy.
Well, this is the thing. So Nike released this week, we got this new crack team full of athletes, scientists, product developers, nutritionists who are trying to work on this. So I spoke to Stephen Mears, a lecturer in sports science and exercise nutrition at Loughborough, to be like, is this actually possible? How has this not been done before? And he said, really, like the actual just pressure that it puts on the athlete's body, because obviously, they are running at super fast paces, like Kipchoge doing it in 2 hours and 3 minutes is just a bit more, but it's like keeping that just pace up for like the entire, for less than 2 hours, which is just, I've never run a marathon. I know Matt Burgess has and is going to, so he knows more about what it's like to run a marathon, but I can imagine it's pretty intense.
I mean, I haven't actually run a full marathon. I've done half marathons just to
lazy.
Clarify. I know it's dreadful, but I think to beat this record, they need to be running at 13 miles an hour and somewhere around 5 minutes a mile for 26.2 miles, which is absolutely ridiculous.
And in terms of the amount that they have to shave off, so it's 7 seconds off for each mile. And you think 7 seconds is a really, really, really long time.
It is. When you boil it down to running a mile, like 7 seconds is such a long amount of time while you're actually doing a single mile, because it's hard to describe how something that seems really small, like I've been talking for more than 7 seconds now, just that per mile for 26 times at your literal physical peak and the fastest that ever any human has traveled for that sort of distance.
So what they're going to do, they're going to run downhill, or they're going to
That Mir said, he said one thing that they could do is change the settings of the run. So it would technically break the 2-hour barrier, but it wouldn't be like a kosher world record.
Right, because to be a proper marathon, it has to have a certain distance between the start and finish, 26.2 miles, and it has to be a certain flatness.
Yeah, exactly. So they could, in order to try and get through that 2-hour barrier, they can do things like make the course slightly downhill or one long straight with the prevailing wind, or use paces, which he explained to me is when So apparently when you run behind someone, it reduces the amount of energy it takes to run, so you can save energy towards the end of the race.
So you get in their slipstream.
Yeah, and he said, so what Nike could do potentially, and this is not saying that this is what Nike is going to do, but this is just one way that it could be done.
Through cheating.
Not cheating, but just, I don't know, just moulding the environment a little bit.
I guess, but if it's not officially, that doesn't officially class it as a marathon then.
Rubbish, they might as well just give up. But the reason that they're involved, I presume, is that they're going to develop some sort of fancy shoe.
Yeah. Well, I think this is definitely the thing that they're working.
Rather than they've just been, run downhill.
Exactly, they've been working on
crack team.
The product development for the shoes for about 2 years, and that they feel like ready at the stage to start properly testing it out. So Nike have said that they're going to be doing this program for about a year, and then sometime next year they will announce the time and place for the actual run. But back to Burgess, you know a lot about funky shoes for running.
Would you want super bouncy shoes? Would they help you run a marathon?
Well, at this very second, I'm wearing a pair of 3D printed running trainers.
Wow.
We have all been admiring your shoes today.
Very streamlined.
I mean, they're weird looking.
Are they molded perfectly to your foot?
Unfortunately, they're not. They are...
They're just 3D printed for someone.
Yeah, they're brand new trainers from Adidas. They cost £240, which is a lot of money, even for a high-end pair of running trainers. And they have just gone on sale in the UK, Tokyo, and New York for the first time. It's the first time that Adidas has actually sold 3D printed running trainers in a limited amount. And yeah,
do they feel different?
They actually are very comfy.
You ran home in them last night because you're energetic and weird.
Yeah, something like that. I did a good 6 miles yesterday, which is 10k, so like
nice.
An average length run, but nothing too much. And they were actually just really comfy to wear, and like these came out of the box brand new with the label still on, and you wouldn't have told me that these are like a new pair of trainers.
So to my mind, a 3D printed pair of shoes would either be one of two things. They'd either feel very flimsy or very stiff, but they don't. They just feel like shoes.
No, they feel incredibly flexible, like just going across different surfaces, they just sort of bent to how I was running, and they're just very comfy. I might not actually ever take them off.
What's actually Gross. Their argument for building them this way, though? Because when you said it, my first thought is if you're going to 3D print something, it means they can be completely personalised to your foot and your gait, and you know that could help you run better if they were actually personalised in that way. But they're not. So is it that the technique enables them to be lighter? That whatever. What is it? Why? Why? Other than a gimmick, why?
I think at the moment it's a bit of a gimmick, yeah. You are right, okay. But the actual goal is to be able to create personalised trainers. Yeah. So I think Adidas in the future are saying, we want to, you walk into a running shop, you run on a treadmill for five minutes, and then we make some trainers that are specific to your running style.
Because they do this now, they'll make you kind of run and they'll look at you and they'll recommend what type of shoe is good for your gait and your style and whatever. But yeah, they should be doing it that
way. Yeah, and I think that is the overall aim, but they're just not quite there yet. The 3D printing technologies aren't quite advanced enough.
You'll have to wait in the shop for cheap enough, several
and quick
days,
enough.
Weeks.
And amazingly, they don't look rubbish.
No, they don't. They actually look quite nice.
You can read all about them on wired.co.uk.
Yeah, and see what they look like.
And see what they look like as well. A visual story in an audio form. Another story that might not be best done audially. There's certainly some interesting pictures. Matt Burgess, you had some interesting times earlier this week with penis bones.
Well, not direct hands-on experience, but...
so to speak.
But lots of fun.
Lots of fun. So penis bones, they are bones that are in penises. Lots of animals have them, mostly primates and carnivores. Humans used to have them, but it's actually been turned out from some new research this week. We have a sort of reason, or definitely a very credible reason.
So it was never known why we evolved away from having a penis bone, which scientifically is called what? It's got a name.
It's actually called a baculum, which is a great name, I think, for any bone. And basically these bones are really diverse and come in lots of different sizes, lots of different animals. So they're in dogs, cats, raccoons, chimpanzees, gorillas. I actually think some sea animals have them as well. And at this point, I actually want to introduce a new feature to the podcast.
We should have a jingle for this, but we don't. Go on.
So we're going to play a game of name that penis bone.
That would be where the jingle would come in. I'll get right on that when I edit this later. Go
on. So I've got three animals here and three different sizes of penis bone, and I want you to match them up. So it's going to be a simple guessing game.
Okay.
So what animal has a 63 centimeter penis bone? Any guesses?
Walrus.
Well, 63
centimeters. James, you've actually spoiled it.
Was it actually a walrus?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
How about a 2 millimeter one?
A rat?
No. This is actually quite a hard game to guess.
It's some sort of fish?
No, it's a marmoset, so a small...
A marmoset?
Yes. So a small monkey?
2 millimetres.
Yeah. And how about the stump-tailed macaque?
Macaque.
That's the one.
What, how long it is?
Yeah, how long do you want?
5 centimetres.
You just read that off my hand.
Amelia,
I did not read it.
But no, that's exactly it. So
good game. We'll be back again with another one next week.
So these bones, basically the point of this is these bones are very diverse and for different animals. And there is actually a point to them that has been found out this week.
But so why don't we have one? We've been without one for about 1.9 million years.
Yeah, so basically humans have evolved not to have one because...
they break a lot.
No, not that. Basically because of the type of sex that we have. So humans are very much, a one partner for most of their life, mating relationships and reproduction. Monogamous, yes. Whereas animals aren't. And animals actually, these bones help to protect the penises of the male animals that have them.
And help to ensure that the reproductive process is successful.
Like, yeah, it
so
is.
So we don't need to have it protected because we only have one partner.
Yeah, and there's a
supposed apparently
there's a couple of other reasons to it as well. So
that's incredible. You don't need it anymore after the first few years. You've reproduced. It's not necessary.
So
is that what they're saying?
you've thrown him.
Sorry, you're just staring at me. I want an answer.
So there's a couple of reasons. So animals they have lots of partners.
Yeah.
Basically, they have a prolonged period of penetration, which is called intromission. Mm-hmm. So humans, the UCL researchers have found out and pulled the data on, the average time from a human from penetration to ejaculation is less than 2 minutes.
Oh, damn it. I was going to make everyone guess that one.
No more guessing.
Whereas in animals that have these sort of penis bones, they go for longer periods, which is about 3 minutes or over 3 minutes. And the penis bones are there to basically be a supportive structure during the penetration and protect the urethra from and stop it from being constricted. And because of the way that animals mate and how they actually have multiple partners, if an animal takes longer to ejaculate and fertilize a female, then they have more chance of being the animal that is successful in producing and reproducing.
So it's a survival of the fittest thing as well, right? They have to compete for partners, so someone that is more successful. So I guess having a strong, well-formed penis bone in this case would give you an advantage over your rivals.
Yeah, it would. And that's the point where humans, basically, when we started to mate and live in different ways around 1.9 million years ago in the Homo erectus period, actually... that's when this bone started to disappear. And because of the way we live, males don't have one.
I do remember seeing a documentary where elephants were... well, a male elephant was attempting to have sex with a female, and it basically involved lots of chasing and running. And I'm pretty sure they were still kind of running while having sex.
But they don't have a penis bone.
So that's pretty dangerous. You need a strong penis bone.
But they don't have one.
They don't?
No.
No, I don't think an elephant does. It would be, I assume it would be longer than the walrus, which has got the longest one of 63 centimetres.
Okay.
There we go. And as you say, they do come in all different shapes and sizes and in a remarkable variety of animal. And it's interesting that there's a very logical reason that we no longer have one.
Yeah, it's literally just evolution is why we don't have one, because we don't need one.
Makes sense. And there's some interesting pictures of penis bones on wired.co.uk if you want to add that to your brain.
You can. They are really interesting. Like, you get in some with points, some with weird, like, teeth.
Matt's
type
gonna
things.
Go on all
some
night
look a bit like medieval weapons.
Teeth. Yeah. They have these
incredible
things to clamp on.
Basically,
so finally, when we see a search result on our site for penis bones, there's an actual reason.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So if we get some Google Analytics result that someone's been searching for penis bones and they end up on wired.co.uk, they'll have found out what they needed
it's
to
legitimate.
Know. Liat Clark. Our final Templeton. Story this week is. Well, not related, but on a similar topic.
Reproduction. It's about the fact that three-person IVF has finally become fully legal in the UK.
So excuse my pretended ignorance, but yes. What is three-person IVF?
So it is essentially a form of IVF where you're taking the genetic material from three people. One man, two women. And the point is to avoid passing on a mitochondrial disorder.
From the mother.
From the mother. Mm. So it's a specific type of IVF that will be used very rarely, only in very serious cases where there is pretty much no doubt that a child conceived naturally from these two parents will end up with the disorder.
Relatively speaking, this has been a fairly long time coming, and it's already a technique that's been used in the wild, so to speak.
Yeah, so it is. The UK is kind of the first country that has fully legalised it and researched it in such a thorough way. This year it made news because a child was born in Mexico through the technique. I think it was American doctors doing the procedure, but it was born in Mexico because they don't have any rules around using the technique there. So in the UK, the human fertile... I'm not going to remember the name. HFEA. Mm-hmm. Which is also known as the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, which is basically the fertility regulator. It's been studying this for years, and they've carried out 4 reviews, and the final review was published just a couple of weeks ago, and basically said, we've looked over the evidence millions of times, not millions, a lot.
So the science has been proven good, the ethics has been proven good.
I mean, people will still debate that forever. People will still obviously debate the ethical ramifications of designer babies, blah, blah, blah.
But this isn't a designer baby.
No, it's not. I think people, you know, some people argue slippery slope, which you could argue with most anything, but the UK has done it in a very careful, cautious, regimented way. And the way they concluded the final review a few weeks ago was to say this should be proceeded with caution. So it's a very kind of well done, well carried out process.
So is it
for anyone that kind of
is it entirely random?
No, it's so basically for the technique to be viable, the parents have to both be carrying the faulty genetic material, essentially. Mm-hmm. For a child to inherit it, both parents would have it. So you have to have a couple coming into this situation with the faulty genetic material. They take a donor from a third woman, and there's various different techniques that can be used in the UK. There's maternal spindle transfer and pronuclear transfer, where you're essentially having 2 embryos created and fertilized, and one of those is created with the mother's egg, one is created from a donor's egg, and you extract the nucleus and swap it in there.
And away
no
you go. But
no
so
problem.
To simplify this down, this could help to eradicate, well, not eradicate, but to not treat either, but to get rid of in certain cases, specifically things like stroke, seizures, blindness, deafness, diabetes, and muscle failure, and a host of other
That's
conditions.
A series of symptoms, yeah. So mitochondrial disease is like a huge range of disorders, and the symptoms are just, those are just some of the symptoms that they can cause. Essentially, mitochondrial inflammation is in every cell in the body pretty much and helps power them. So when they're not working properly, it can cause organs to not function properly and can prove fatal in a lot of cases. In the situation in Mexico where the child was born, his parents had already lost 2 children to a mitochondrial disorder. So for them, it was, you know, they wanted to conceive naturally.
And
this was the only way.
How successful has it proven to be in the trials and in the research that's gone on?
So there was a study published in Nature earlier this year. There's been 2 in Nature that have basically said, we're good to go, guys, and it leads to normal pregnancies. However, there is a bit of a disclaimer in that sometimes the faulty mitochondrial information you don't want to pass does actually get passed on to the fertilised embryo, to the embryo. And I think they estimated that in 1 in 8 cases, the information could be passed on. So, I mean, that doesn't sound great, but in 100% of the cases, if they'd conceived naturally, the information would be passed on. So I guess that they've decided it's still worth a gander, a pretty difficult gander.
So this has been approved now in the UK, has it? And if it has, like, when are we going to see this as a thing that's happening here?
So it was actually made legal, went through Parliament last year. This year, the HFEA published its final set of reviews. And today, on, 15th of December, we are recording, they have announced that mitochondrial donation is legal. And how it will work is clinics across the country can apply for a permit to actually carry out the procedure. And the HFEA grants them, they investigate the clinics, the staff, the skills, the equipment, everything. And they'll do it on a case-by-case basis, even with patients. So once they have the permits, they can start accepting patients. And next year, we could have the first child born in the UK if we've got any good clinics, which we do, because a lot of the research was done in Newcastle. And I think a couple of NHS hospitals in Newcastle is where we are going to expect to see the first procedures taking place. So it's quite exciting.
This is just with just in case a parent is a carrier of mitochondria disease. It's not going to for anything else.
No, it's not for anything else. So it's incredibly specific. Like, a lot of work has gone into something that is only going to help a small number of people. And
I think in this case, we've seen a dwindling of the argument that, oh, it's playing God and we mustn't play God, because it is so targeted and so specific. And there's such not a necessity, but arguably there is, for it. It's a problem that we can solve. It's not designer babies.
Exactly. And the way the transfer of genetic material happens, well, I obviously don't know the ins and outs of it, otherwise I'd be in a different job. But I think 99.9% of the parent's DNA is still in the embryo intact. It's that 0.1%, which is just the mitochondrial information, just these cells that help power the body and convert food into energy in the cell. So it's a very specific kind of physical interaction. It's not going to dictate what you're like as a person, what you look like. And obviously that's the kind of thing where people are scared it's tampering with you know, who we are at our core and changing that. This is such a specific case where you're taking this bit of information that doesn't have anything to do with who you are as a person. So that I think that's why hopefully, you know, people will accept it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area of scientific research, and you can read a lot more about it on wired.co.uk, as with all the stories that we talked about on the podcast this week. We're careering towards Christmas. Matt Burgess, this will be your last podcast of the year, I believe, but in early 2017, you are making your first trip to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, Nevada, to find out all the things that we'll be getting excited about in terms of shiny products in 2017. Are you excited?
I'm incredibly excited.
Do you gamble?
I don't gamble.
That's probably a good thing. Well, you never win.
No, that's true.
No, the casinos would like to think otherwise. So we'll see you again in the new year. Who else? Leah, you're here next week, or are you away?
I am here next week.
You're here next week, and Amelia?
Yep, I'll be here next week.
I think we're going to have a bumper podcast.
To the bitter end.
Yeah, everyone that isn't here, everyone that is here will be on the podcast. So we'll have a very, very...
You're going to listen to us drinking and laughing and singing carols for an hour.
Yes.
How dreamy.
Look forward to that. And Matt, we'll see you again next year, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
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 Bye.